Welcome back to The Exchange on KUCB. I'm Stephanie Joyce. In the second half of our program today, I'm joined by a telephone by anthropologist and archaeologist Chuck Mobley. He recently published a book that explores the camps in Southeast Alaska where Unangan villagers were evacuated during World War II. Thanks for joining me, Dr. Mobley.
Thank you for having me.
And let me just remind listeners that they can call in with questions or comments. The number is 581-1888, or you can send an email to news@kucb.org. So let's just start by catching listeners up who maybe aren't familiar with the relocation. After the bombing of Unalaska in 1942, the military decided to relocate the entire civilian population of the Aleutian and Pribilof Islands. And in many cases, people were given just a few hours to pack their belongings before they were loaded onto transport ships and sent off to Southeast Alaska. Can you pick up the story from there, Dr. Mobley, and tell us, you know, where did they go and what did it look like?
Yes, there were two different voyages mainly, and the Pribilof Islanders arrived in Thunder Bay in Southeast Alaska on Admiralty Island first, and they were offloaded at a cannery, a defunct cannery. There was a defunct mine a mile away, and the St. Paul Islanders stayed at the cannery and made that their home for the next couple years, three years. And the St. George Islanders were taken to the mine the next day, and that's where they set up their home. And then villagers from Atka were on the same boat, and they were taken that same evening to a herring factory just outside of Angoon on Admiralty Island. That place was called Killisnoo. Then the remainder of the group came subsequently. At that point in time, a camp was set up, a temporary receiving camp was set up at the Wrangell Institute, which was just outside of Wrangell. And when villagers came there, they spent a few weeks and were processed, they were given some materials to build a camp with or improve a camp. And the people from Unalaska were sent to a defunct cannery at not that far from Wrangell called Burnett Inlet. And then the remainder were taken by ship to Ketchikan and were put up at a defunct sea. Well, it wasn't quite defunct at that point in time. It had just been vacated by military personnel, but a CCC camp. It was at Ward Lake, north of Ketchikan, about 10 miles.
Now, so obviously most of the villagers were taken to canneries, and you don't address it in your book, but has your research answered the question, why canneries? Why were they taken to these very isolated, remote locations?
There are different answers to that, depending on which location we're discussing. These were hundreds of people, and so the sorts of facilities that were available to house several hundred people at a time on short notice were outside of what they considered to be the war theater were not all that common. So some of these arrangements for camps were negotiated during the voyage. Some were done afterwards. Some of it was political. The camp at the mining camp at Thunder Bay, for example, was had a major financial interest on the part of a very well-connected person in Juneau at the time. So those kinds of things came into play.
And so you wrote this book to determine whether the six camps should be listed as National Historic Landmarks, which, as I understand, is a designation that indicates both their historical significance and their present value. Can you tell me about the steps you took to make that determination?
Yes, the National Historic Landmark Program is administered by the National Park Service, and there are very strict protocols and definitions for what constitutes a National Historic Landmark, and it has to have very high integrity, good preservation, and a lot of significance or cultural meaning. So the goal of this project, which started just about 5 years ago, was to determine whether these six properties, and that's the mine and the cannery at Thunder Bay and the Wrangell Institute and the Burnett Inlet Cannery and the Killisnoo Herring Factory and Ward Lake, whether they all together qualified as a National Historic Landmark. So the Park Service and the Aleutian Pribilof Heritage Group sponsored the project. Most of the money was federal. And we went to these various places in one long week and took a lot of photographs, did some oral history interviews on tape with people, did some archival research, and put this together to document what these sites looked like before World War II and the Aleutian evacuation, what they looked like during the evacuation, and what kinds of improvements were made by the natives that inhabited the camps, and then finally, what happened to them afterwards? How did these places change, and how were they used, and on up to the present day? So the outcome of that was that, yes, indeed, the six locations are quite significant, but for different reasons for different places, the integrity is very low. Many of these camps have few or no buildings left, and so the outcome was that they did not qualify to be a National Historic Landmark. That doesn't lessen the historic significance of these places. It just means that they're not intact enough to qualify as a National Historic Landmark.
Yeah, and in reading your book, I guess one of the things that surprised me the most was how few indicators of the internment you actually found. You did mention that at Funner Bay, someone had found in the 1980s a toy wooden boat that had very likely been crafted during the internment in the rafters of one of the buildings. But really, you know, there wasn't a lot of physical evidence of the time that the Unangan people spent in the camps. Maybe you can elaborate on why do you think there were so few physical remnants of that time?
Well, first let me describe what the physical remnants are. There are that little toy boat that you mentioned is a novel artifact, and I saw photographs once taken in St. George of children playing in the mud puddles, pulling wooden boats just like this. In fact, Andronik Kashevirov Sr. is identified as one of the children in those photographs. Other artifacts that remain have been preserved in museums. For example, the women at Atka made traditional basketry out of local materials, and some of those items have been retained and kept in museums. The facilities were makeshift in the first place and not in very good shape when they moved in. The materials that they were given to provide additional housing were also flimsy and not intended for a long life, and these places just deteriorated afterwards. The main remnants that show in the present time are a cemetery at Funter Bay, which has both graves from both St. George and the St. Paul Islanders, a cemetery at Killisnoo, which holds some individuals that died there from the Atka village. In Ketchikan, there were no specific interments at the camp, but there are individuals buried at the local Ketchikan cemetery. As far as buildings go that were constructed by the Aleuts during the evacuation, there are a few, we would probably call them shacks, that are descending into the ground at the Funter Bay Cannery. At Ward Lake, the Forest Service managed the Ward Lake camp, and immediately after, I mean, before the boat even left, the Forest Service was advertising to tear that camp down, and a lot of the buildings were moved intact to the village, the native village of Saxman, Tlingit village south of Ketchikan. So because of the materials and shortage of materials, these places were cannibalized, and building materials were taken and buildings were torn down, and it just disintegrates over time.
So this book that you wrote is in some ways a partner to the Lost Villages Project, which the National Park Service has been doing, taking former residents back to the Lost Villages in and around Unalaska, and also organizing the Attu reunion last year. How do you see the work that you've done documenting these camps fitting into the bigger story about the Unangan relocation?
Well, it's certainly a component, and certainly the documentation of the villages that natives were not allowed to return to is an important part of the story, that they all together form a whole. There's some time continuum to them. The 3 or 4 years during the relocation that people spent in Southeast, or the period of time when those villages that were not returned to were not occupied, and so it occupies sort of an interim period in those people's lives.
Well, Dr. Mobley, that's all the time that we have, but thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. I should mention that the Park Service is going to make this volume available as a PDF on their webpage for the World War II National Historic Area.
All right. So if folks would like to get a copy of your book, they can contact the National Park Service or look it up on the web.
Both, yes.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.